This AgriTalk podcast is brought to you by Acuron Corn Herbicide from Syngenta, an upgrade for growers who don't settle for average. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. All right. I've got my I voted sticker already, snuck into the polling center shortly after voting started this morning. That's my normal voting time. The line for the voting booth was pretty typical, but it's going to be a long day for the leaders of the Democrat and Republican parties with control for Congress up for grabs at today's midterms.
From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is AgriTalk, agriculture's national talk show since 1994. Here's your host, Chip Flory.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us again this morning. Welcome to AgriTalk. Today is the day. Voting booths are open across the country for the midterm elections. Control of the U.S. House and Senate up for grabs with some very close races in farm state house districts. Historically, guys, it's not unusual for the president's party to lose some Senate seats and a fairly hefty number of House seats in the first midterm of a president's first term. The trick the Republican Party is trying to pull off is retaining control of either the House or the Senate. And retaining control of both, that would darn near be a miracle. We'll get more perspective on this from Informa policy analyst Roger Bernard in the second half of the show. But first, we'll get the latest on that case of bovine TB up in Wisconsin. And we'll talk about sustainability in the beef industry with Dawn Caldwell from the Federation of States Beef Councils and Ashley McDonald from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Sustainability in agriculture is a controversial issue. I mean, there's no question about that. And part of the problem all along has just been defining sustainability. Well, beef industry has been doing just that. We'll get an update later this morning. And of course, we want you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call. It's 855-4-TALK-AG. That's 855-482-5524. If you'd rather let us know what you're thinking via Twitter, make sure that you include hashtag AgriTalk in the message. Right now, let's turn it over to Clinton Griffiths, get an update on the news. Clinton,
yo,
it's the day, man.
It is the day. I got myself up 6 o'clock, headed over to the poll, 6:15 in line. I was number 17 already.
Wow.
Yeah, number 17 already.
How was the line behind you?
It was just starting to pick up. Right? As I walked out, people were starting to pour in about 6:30. Yep. So,
yeah,
you know,
they're that's saying part of this, the story in this, isn't it?
I know,
Clinton?
The turnout is just going to be unbelievable. Well, here's the thing, Chip, you and I were discussing. The fact we're even talking about a midterm election, let alone seeing the kind of turnout that we've already seen, you know, the early voting, early ballots, they're saying somewhere between 31 and 36 million ballots already cast before today.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then you throw on top of that, the number of people, like they're saying maybe a third or more of all Americans may go vote, which, you know, the fact that we're having that kind of turnout, to me, regardless of how this thing turns out, right, how it comes out, whatever, the fact that so many people are participating in the process is good.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes. Exactly. And the estimates are that we could go over 100 million on the vote. You know, like you said, a third of the population here in the country. Now, if that happens, ignore everything that the polls have said, because the polls, I'm not going to say that they're worthless when you get this huge voter turnout, but they're less reliable.
Well, and it's hard to, you know, all of these formulas and everything they've been doing has been on kind of standard midterm election turnout. This is not standard by any stretch of the imagination. Not standard at all. One of the things that has happened, we spent $5.2 billion by candidates, political parties, and outside groups on the House and Senate contests alone. That comes from the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. Huge. Wow. Record spending.
Wow. Well, I tell you what. In the state of Iowa, always gets high, a lot of spending on during the elections. But with the race in District 1, with the governor's race, the spending has been just,
well,
you know what?
We've
I'll
all
call
got
it
to
heartbreaking.
Enjoy
I'll call it heartbreaking. It's been that much.
Yeah, we've all got to enjoy them. I'm ready to move on to something else. College basketball starts tonight, so how about that? How about that? We got that going for us.
Cyclones versus Alabama State.
Come on now. Big game.
Let's bring it.
Here we go. Hey, we still have plenty of crops out in the field. We got that crop progress report. 76% of corn crop still in. 83% of soybeans are now harvested. Bill Biederman, he calculates it this way, Chip, and I find this pretty interesting. 2.59 billion bushels of corn in key states still sitting in the field.
Right. Yeah, and that is exactly the right way to do it.
Right, 400 million bushels of beans. His question is, what's the loss potential of what's out there still?
Significant.
Some of these crops, the weather has not been good. They're going, I mean, you're not looking at the top of the top yield on this stuff.
No, absolutely not. And with the conditions that we've had out there, I mean, it's not like the reason those crops are still out there is it's not a market issue. It's not a time of the year issue. It's none of that. It's because conditions have been so terrible to get out and get these 2.6 billion bushels of corn and 400 million bushels of beans out of the field. Right. Now, if conditions stink that bad, what's the quality of that crop that's still out there?
Yeah.
I'll
tell you what it looks like in my house. Not great.
Right.
Not great.
Right.
The ears don't look good. You know, and that's starting to be something we're talking about, vomitoxins and all of the, you know, ear molds and everything else that goes with all that. You know, it all turns into
a storage issue.
Well, and then we've got, you know, the tillage that didn't get done. We've got compaction for next year. All that goes together. Hey, we got a new ag economy barometer rebounded a touch in October to 136, 22-point increase on some of the trade news. Good sentiment there, so we'll keep an eye on that.
I wonder if Jim Mintert at Purdue University ever anticipated this much volatility month to month in that ag barometer.
I don't think he did.
I don't think he did either. A 22-point surge in that barometer is pretty astounding.
Absolutely.
So, all right, Clinton. Thanks, man.
You bet.
Let's bring in Jim Dickrell, Editor Emeritus, Dairy Herd Management. Jim, we got a confirmed case of bovine TB up in Wisconsin. It's a pretty rare thing, but it happened.
It did. Wisconsin has been TB-free since 1980, so this is, 48 years?
Yeah.
But they confirmed the case last week. It's in a single herd. They're doing a lot of testing, not only in that herd, but in herds that the infected herd had sold cattle to or bought cattle from. And as long as they do that comprehensive testing, the state can remain, certified free.
Right.
So that won't require additional testing or movement restrictions and that type of thing.
Right. So have we got an idea of how it happened?
Yeah. And that's, again, an interesting case where, again, it's not totally confirmed, but they do have a preliminary DNA match with a Hispanic worker that worked on this dairy back in 2015. That worker went through the treatment protocols, and he has been cleared, and he didn't return to the farm. But there is this human-to-cattle transfer that did occur, and this, you know, has occurred in other states. It's not frequent, but it does happen. So that just reinforces the need for, you know, producers to test their workers to make sure they're not bringing it in.
Absolutely. Real quick, Jim, what's next in this case?
They're going to just continuing to test and make sure that it hasn't spidered out.
Okay.
And hopefully it will not find any additional cases.
Exactly. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Yep. See you later.
That is Jim Dickrell, Editor Emeritus of Dairy Herd Management. Coming up next, we're talking about sustainability in the beef industry.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
They say to really know a man, you have to walk a mile in his boots. Well, my channel Seedsman has logged more miles than I can count in mine. As crops grow, so does his commitment to making sure there's nothing overlooked. And come harvest, we celebrate in the cab. him working away making plans for next season. Look, anybody can sell you seed. Only a Channel seedsman gives you everything you need to make the most of it. Find yours at channel.com/boots.
Growers face enough worries today. SDS and nematodes shouldn't be among them. Alevo seed treatment from BASF is the only product that offers effective protection against both SDS and nematodes throughout the critical growing period. Growers get amazing early season protection for stronger profit potential at harvest. So worry about weather. Don't worry about SDS or nematodes with Alevo. To find out more about Alevo and how to protect your soybeans, talk to your seed dealer or your BASF rep. Grow smart with BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
When you think of Palmer Amaranth, water hemp, ragweed, and mare's tail, doesn't it just make you want to give them the pounding they deserve? Now you can with Diflex Duo Herbicide. It's the post-emergence corn herbicide with two proven sites of action. So you get powerful control of the toughest weeds, built-in resistance management, and excellent crop safety. So don't just hit weeds. Pound them like never before with Diflex Duo. Learn more at DiflexDuo.us. Always read and follow label instructions.
I'm joined by Don Porter, Herbicide Technical Product Lead for Syngenta. Don, what were some of the most common weed challenges you heard about from corn growers across the Corn Belt during 2018, and how might we manage them better in 2019?
Yeah, great question, Chip. Giant ragweed, Palmer, amaranth, and water hemp were probably the top three that I heard about. Also some reports regarding mare's tail or morning glory, depending on that geography. The best practice to manage these tough weeds would be to use an effective pre followed by a very effective post-emergence application. Each of those applications should contain multiple effective sites of action. A recent University of Illinois study, also in conjunction with USDA, on glyphosate-resistant water hemp found that growers who use 2.5 effective sites of action are 83 times less likely to develop resistance than farmers who use 1.5 effective sites of action. So a very important key study there. And that's one of the great things about Acuron herbicide with its four active ingredients and three effective sites of action. It will deliver effective and consistent control of those tough weeds.
Okay, Don, for guys like me that don't understand this, explain what that effective site of action is.
Right. So herbicides each have a mode of action which is the nuclear warhead that kills those weeds. And in using multiple effective sites of action, so herbicides that deliver different sites of action on that weed, provide overall better control and allows for better resistance management, because rather than just one effective mode of action, if you got two working on that weed, then that weed is going to struggle very, very difficultly to try to overcome that herbicide. So if you use two effective sites of action, then the chances are you're going to have better weed control and better overall resistance management of those herbicides.
Very cool. And Acuron's got three effective sites of action. So that's cool stuff. Thank you so much. That was Don Porter with Syngenta with insights on how to upgrade your control of tough weeds next season.
New Dallaro fungicide for corn and soybeans can help you achieve personal best yields.
And welcome back to AgriTalk, everybody. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Okay, sustainability in agriculture. It's one of those issues and topics that I'll admit I've been a little bit hesitant to do too much about it and with it and on it here on AgriTalk, just simply because I'm sure that there's some eye rolling going on out there. Well, you know what? Tough. Get used to it, because sustainability is a word, a concept that consumers want their food to be associated with. So we need to discuss it. We need to talk about it. We're going to do that today with Dawn Caldwell. Dawn is the 2018 NCBA chairman of the Federation of Beef Councils. She joins me now. Dawn, how are you today?
I am doing well. I'm good. Doing well. It's
good.
Yeah, it's a great day in the state of Nebraska. That's what I
was going to say. You're out in Nebraska, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're a little damp again, and harvest might eventually get done, hopefully before Thanksgiving. But we keep chugging along.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's been a long and drawn out one, not only in Nebraska, but in other areas west of the Mississippi. Good grief. But Nebraska's right there with it. We've also got Ashley McDonald. She is the Senior Director of Sustainability for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Ashley, welcome to AgriTalk.
Well, thanks for having me.
You bet. Ashley, I want to start with you on this, because this has been a process. I mean, defining sustainability and determining a common goal throughout the beef industry. I'm sure that it's a process that's still evolving, isn't it?
Well, you know, sustainability, first of all, is something that the cattle industry should be extremely proud of. You know, we have one of the best stories, I think, of any industry to tell, and especially here in the United States. So, you know, it's not something that we probably should roll our eyes about, although I know there are those out there that will do it. You know, it should be something that we're touting. You know, we should, hang a medal on our chest because, you know, we are the most sustainable, beef production system in the world. And it's something that we should talk about and not be, I guess, annoyed about, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I think part of the annoyance in the industry, Ashley, it came about because it was a consumer-driven issue rather than a producer-driven issue. If we would have been out in front of it, it would have been one of those topics that, like you said, I think the beef industry would be leading the way in agriculture and saying, hey, look at what we're doing over here. We do have a sustainable industry.
Well, you know, I think we have, you know, we have been leading. If you look at kind of what we've done over the last 100 years or even the last 50 years, it's amazing. And I just don't think that we have, one, we haven't recognized it as sustainable production. So that's been a challenge. And we just have to really just utilize that word. But, you know, if we look back to 1977, we produced the same amount of beef with 33% fewer animals.
Right.
That's a huge sustainability win for our industry, and it's something we should talk about. So, you know, I think we have been leading in this space. We just haven't taken credit for actually leading in this space.
Exactly. Exactly. And Dawn, the, like I said at the start of the segment, the sustainability, it's a concept that consumers want associated with the food that they're consuming, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting how it seems that many consumers might have a piece of sustainability as their perception of what that means to them. And we've been really accurate in what I believe we've been really inclusive and accurate in the beef industry in assessing what sustainability is, acknowledging that it's more than just environmental, but it's also critical that we acknowledge economics and the ability to continue to stay in business. And there's a social aspect to it as well. What will consumers be accepting of or embrace or not? You know, I guess I can look at it as what will not chase them away from consuming our product. And so all of those things fit together in sustainability for the producers, for the industry, for the entire value chain. And getting somebody at the consumer level to think that big is really difficult. So we have to eat that cow a bite at a time, I guess, to help them understand that there's more to it than just what they see, but we acknowledge and respect what they see too.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ashley, what are you doing at NCBA as far as studies, as far as proving the sustainability of beef?
Sure. Well, I think there's a couple things that we continue to try to do, and the industry has really, you know, made an effort and an investment in looking at those different aspects. So there is the beef industry life cycle assessment that goes back a number of years now, and hopefully soon we'll get an updated even version of that. But that shows, you know, our improvement across the board, even from just 2005 to 2011, we had improvements across almost all environmental factors. And so, you know, that's a huge, very scientifically based tool that we can use to show that not only are we just more efficient in improving those things, but we're also committed to looking for progress, looking for those areas where we can make even more progress. And I think that's to Don's point about thinking about what the consumer really is hungry and craving. You know, that's what we need to show them. You know, we need to show them that, yes, we have a wonderful legacy that we are going to build upon, and we will continue to do that because that's what the cattle industry has always done. But we are committed, and we are saying that we're committed to seeking out those opportunities for further improvement. And so, you know, I think if we look at the scientific tools we have through the LCA, and then on some of the policy fronts of bringing people together in some of these stakeholder initiatives, NCBA is a part of a couple of them. One is the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, and that is bringing, you know, people from throughout the supply chain together to talk about beef sustainability, share knowledge about what we have done. Why have we improved so much in 50 years? And we can share that information throughout the supply chain, and ultimately that gets funneled down to the consumer, which improves confidence in our product, improves demand, and ultimately that all benefits the cow-calf producer at the other end.
Yeah, that confidence, that is part of the equation, no doubt about it. Don, do you find that consumers generally are receptive of the information that we've got on sustainability in the beef industry?
Most times they really are, and I've had some interesting visits with different major retailers of our product.
Yeah.
And they will say that, you know, consumers are demanding this, or consumers are asking this when they come to the counter or when they order off the menu. So they ultimately are making the choice in their purchase or ingredient purchasing contracts on behalf of the consumers. So not only our consumer information efforts really important, but really reaching out to our major retailers that market the beef product for us is incredibly important too, because if they put a list of mandates on us as producers,
yes,
listen to everything Ashley described, and we're doing such a great job as an industry, we must validate that to those retailers so they can with confidence sell to their consumers saying, hey, the beef folks got this. They know what they're doing. Here's areas where they're working on doing things differently or improving, and eat their product and enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you, Greg Henderson at Grover's was the one that has been convincing me that, listen, we should be wearing, like you said, Ashley, I mean, let's put a medal on the beef, on the chest of the beef industry when it comes to sustainability. And when we first started talking about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't McDonald's one of the first to come out and say, listen, we're going to put sustainably produced beef on the menu? And profitability for the cattleman has to be part of the equation in sustainability. Is that right, Ashley?
It is, you know, and that's something that I think is a successful endeavor that we've kind of been down
yes.
is to, again, get the retailer, as Don described it, you know, get those retailers and everybody throughout the supply chain, get them in the room to talk about these things, and they will start to understand exactly, you know, the wonderful things that we have done, including considering economics and everything that we do. And I think we've been extremely successful about, you know, hopefully getting people to understand that is, if not the threshold question, that has to be asked before anything else can be done at the feedlot or at the ranch. I think it's, you know, at least as big as the environmental and the social piece, right? And so we have to continually talk about that.
Exactly. Dawn, I've got a short amount of time here, but how are beef producers responding to this message?
Somewhat like you described as you introduced this segment.
Yeah.
There are folks out there that say, clearly we've been around for over 100 years. We shouldn't have to talk about this. We shouldn't have to be on the different boards that Ashley described. However, the validation process is extremely important to today's consumers. And so we need to be open-minded. We need to see the whole forest, not individual trees, and behave accordingly.
Guys, thank you so much for the update on this. It's such an important issue. We'll talk soon again about it, okay? Thank you, Ashley. Thanks, Dawn.
Thank you.
All right, that's Ashley McDonald, NCBA, and Dawn Caldwell, Chairman of the Federation of Beef Councils.
Current price times 1,000 acres, carry the one.
These days, it's hard to make the math work for your soybean fields. The BASF Liberty Link system with Liberty Herbicide makes it easier. Start with a 2-plus bushel per acre yield advantage. Add in lower system input costs and more complete weed control, and you get an extra $33 or more profit potential per acre compared to Asgrow Roundup Ready to Extend soybeans. Grow smart with Liberty Link and BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
The mighty Prosaro, king of fungicides. Its fast action and long residual make it the keeper of grain quality and yield, the hammer of head and leaf diseases, the number one reducer of scab. When your goal is greater wheat quality and higher yield, use Prosaro fungicide, and the crown of higher profit will be yours. Learn more at prosaro.us. Always read and follow label instructions.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, this wheat market, we've got a little bit of strength going here this morning.
We do, Chip. You know, I think that's tied back to yesterday's crop condition and progress data. You know, the condition came in lower than what was anticipated. And the planting and emergence progress just has been slowed by the heavy rains down through the southern plains here. And while it's hard to get too concerned at this point in the year about the wheat crop, I think it's enough to cause a little bit of short covering. That's what we're seeing with this morning's price action.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, Kansas 83% seeded versus a five-year average of 95%. And you got to wonder just how much more wheat they're going to want to put in the ground with it being November now. What's going on in corn and soybeans?
Well, you know, we did see a little bit of choppy price action earlier, but now it's mostly lower here, 2 to 3 cents down in the soybeans and about a penny lower in the corn market. So not a whole lot going on, to be honest with you, just kind of a little bleed lower so far this morning.
Still waiting and anticipating those reports on Thursday. Well, and the results from today.
Yeah, I think that those are the focal points. You know, to a lesser degree, the FOMC meeting comes out on Thursday as well. So, you know, possibly something there, most likely not anything, any movement on interest rates this month. But, you know, all those factors just kind of waiting in that pause mode right now.
Yeah, that doggone hog market down a bit yesterday, and it's got some follow-through selling today.
Yeah, we saw bearish reversals yesterday, so a poor close there and follow through, like you mentioned today. We're sharply lower across the board there. And the cattle market, it's strong in the face of the pressure in soybeans. It's showing just mild strength, but it's still impressive.
Gotcha. There. That's Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Hi, I'm Ag Day host Clinton Griffiths, and I invite you to join me each morning as we cover the nation's food system, from fields of green to orchards of orange and livestock everywhere in between. America runs on agriculture, and here at Ag Day, agriculture's what we do best. Listen as our analysts track the markets, learn about innovations in technology and sustainability, and live the country lifestyle through the eyes of rural America. Join me, Clinton Griffiths, for Ag Day, the country experience.
Prepare for the future of ag technology at Farm Journal Media's Ag Tech Expo, December 3rd through the 5th in Indianapolis. Whether you're a novice or a tech-savvy early adapter, Ag Tech is your go-to source for the latest in the industry. Customize your event experience and gain a competitive edge with more than 25 educational breakout sessions focused on precision ag, using data, machinery and iron, and sustainable technology. Grower and retailer registrations only $99. Sign up today at www.farmjournalagtechexpo.com.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
And welcome back to AgriTalk, everybody. Like I said at the start of the show, today is it. Today's the midterm elections. The control of the House, control of the Senate, it is up for grabs. And we're going to talk about some of the tight races now with Roger Bernard. Roger is the policy analyst at Informa. Roger, how you doing today, man?
I am doing good. Have voted. I'm locked and ready to go.
Yeah, I got my voted sticker, too.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
It is. Got to get those done. Hey, I do want to talk about the House and Senate, obviously. But Wiesmeyer this morning in his comments on ProFarmer.com brought up an interesting point about some of the gubernatorial races that are going on out there. Roger, are you seeing anything in those state races that are really catching your attention?
Well, I think the those are ones that you never can ignore. They certainly have got a lot of potential. Right now Republicans have got like 33 of the governorships out there, and Democrats hold 16, and there's one independent in the mix too. Now 36 of the contests are up today. Republicans have got 26 to defend. Wow. That's a big number. It's kind of like, you look at the U.S. Senate. That's a big task to do. And indications are, you might see the Democrats pick up some 10 governorships in here. So, that's going to create some interesting things in terms of that, down ballot, poll that you always, that's always possible when you get into these races. So, that is an area, boy, you just can't ignore that when we start looking at what could happen today.
Well, and to talk about the potential, let's say that the Democrat candidates in those 10 races do win and 10 states flip. How does that impact policy making and just the political environment going forward if something like that would happen?
Well, it's going to change, on the state levels, obviously. It starts shifting things around, puts different priorities into the mix. Probably, in some cases could be, less focus on budget cutting if that's where that state has ended up. It could be getting a little bit more spending in the mix. Then also you have to look at, too, when we start looking at census results and things like that, you get even into the possibilities. If you look at redistricting, depending on what the census, results come back at,
sure,
that starts to play a role, too, in terms of, control on the state level. So, there's some longer term implications that can come from some of these state shifts.
Yeah, no question about it. And then when you look forward to the 2020 elections, right now, what was it, 33 states held by Republican governors? Yeah. So you would assume that in a couple of years, if those 33 states are still held by Republican governors, that President Trump would be much more welcome in that state in 2 years I shouldn't even say 2 years, Roger. Good grief. For you and me here in the state of Iowa, the 2020 elections start today. Right?
Well, it actually started a couple, 3 months ago, I think, the number of folks that have made these little pass-through visits through Iowa. We don't see them folks other than about every two and a half years. So, campaign mode is going to be upon us real quick. That certainly, the number of governorships, that also does make a difference, for Mr. Trump as he campaigns through there. That makes a difference in who gets to be up on the podium on the dais with him in terms of, those campaign appearances that he makes. Yep. Whereas he's gone to a lot of them where there's some close congressional races, having a Republican governor on down, whereas, he's got to dig a little deeper down the list if there's a Democrat in charge.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. If you can't have the top political personality in the state, the top official in the state on the stage with you, it starts to lose some of its effectiveness. So yesterday,
yesterday,
Roger, we had David Wasserman from Cook Political Report on the show, and some of the numbers that we were going through, it just absolutely amazes me. But here's one of the most interesting things. They're one of the categories that they look at is solid for an incumbent in a state or right now in the House, they're saying that 182 seats are solid for the Democrats, 137 seats are solid for the Republicans. But when you put the solid and likely into the same category, you've got 192 Democrat and 193 Republican. I mean, that shows us just how much of a toss-up this really is.
Yeah, there are going to be a number of these races that are going to be very close. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, you always get those big question marks as the polls close in the East. You know, Does that affect how things, continue on as you move westward across this great
there
country?
There is momentum in these elections, isn't there?
Oh, there certainly can be. You bet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and especially if you get a couple of those key races that fall into one of the other party's hands, you know, that can, kind of like markets, that can sort of feed on itself, you know. So, this is going to be one of the most interesting things. I think you're going to see a very heavy turnout, in a midterm, especially, you've already got record advanced voting, early voting that's gone on, you've already got very high interest. The polls going into here had, really high levels, and both parties very interested now in this election. So, I know it's always, trite to say, and I know Wasserman probably said this yesterday, but turnout is going to be the key.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no question about it. And we did talk yesterday with Wasserman about it. When you get into the high turnout elections, the polls become less reliable. The analysis becomes less reliable because as you get more numbers, it just becomes more unpredictable out there. So, it's going to be interesting to see how things how the momentum does build. So the toss up seats out there. 3 Democrat, 47 Republican, according to David yesterday. The history shows, I think it was Sean Spicer, I saw his numbers this morning. Historically, the president's party in the president's first midterm election, the president's party loses 5 Senate seats, loses 38 House seats. Are those numbers kind of line up with what you're thinking, Raj?
Well, I think that could end up being a little heavy for the Senate, actually, because I still think the Republicans will keep the Senate.
Okay.
Which means they're gonna maintain at least their 51-49. I struggle to see when you've got a couple of the key races that really are going to be watched, and that's I think primarily going to be Missouri and North Dakota.
Yeah.
See, if the Republicans take those. Then the task for the Democrats is, I won't say impossible, but it becomes a lot
difficult.
Bigger task.
Difficult. Yeah, what really about Montana does. In that?
Oh, boy. That one is going to be interesting. I mean, Tester's popular.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Trump himself has been in Montana probably more times than I think he ever probably thought he would be, when 2 to 4 years ago. You've poured a lot into that state, and it's going to boil down to how much does each party's base get and or keep the interest, right up to the time that people march into that polling booth.
Yeah, and you got to throw Indiana into this one too, don't you, with Donnelly?
Yes. Yeah, that one's going to be, that one's going to be an interesting one, too, because that I think has maybe ended up closer than a lot of people thought it could as well. So, and if you get Heitkamp and Donnelly, that could be probably the biggest change that you'll see on the Senate Ag Committee in terms of, you get a new face. You're not going to see if Republicans, like I think they will, keep the Senate, you're not going to see that Senate Ag panel focus change hardly at all. Pat's still going to be the chairman. Stabenow's still going to be the ranking member. You know, you just add a couple of different faces down the aisle, and there you go.
Mm-hmm. Randy Russell was on with me and Jim here, I think it was last week. And when we brought up Heitkamp and we brought up Donnelly, and I think you can throw Tester into this as well. Those are 3 Democrats that lean towards moderate. And I wonder if their moderation and their political views isn't hurting them in this race some. What do you think?
Well, I think that is going to be an interesting one to see just exactly how their moderate views shape up. I mean, I guess what real boils down to is their moderate views going to cost them enough? Those three being Democrats, is it going to cost them enough on their side of the aisle versus gaining them enough off of Republican voters?
Yep.
That's where it really boils down to. Especially North Dakota and Montana, you've got a largely rural state. And that's, you can't be an extremist on either party necessarily and assured of, returning.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Okay, we're talking with Roger Bernard, Informa policy analyst, on today, the day of the midterm elections. We just got Roger's call on the Senate. He thinks that the Republicans are going to maintain control of the Senate. What's he think about the House? How does that going to end up? We'll find out what Roger thinks next.
Find it now at shopfarmjournal.com. Brand new to the shop is the best of tractor tales as seen each week on U.S. Farm Report. This 2-DVD set features dozens of classic machines and the collectors who bring them back to life. You'll get one DVD that's all green, the best of John Deere. The second DVD includes classics like Alice Chalmers and many more. Buy one DVD for $29.95 or buy the set for $49.95. Order today at shopfarmjournal.com or call toll-free 877-847-9599. You can find it now at shopfarmjournal.com.
Save time and capitalize on market opportunities with Pro Farmer's Daily Advice Monitor. Whether on your desktop or on your phone, visit tryprofarmer.com and get a generous one-month free trial. Pro Farmer only focuses on the news that impacts the market, so you won't scroll through pages of articles to find what's really impacting your business. Plus, get full access to cash bids, charting tools, and more. Visit tryprofarmer.com right now. That's tryprofarmer.com.
First-generation farmers are a special breed. Farm Journal business editor Annalisa Laca helps these ag unicorns tell their story on a new podcast, The First Years.
It may have been hard, but there's a lot of good things that came out of it. A lot of time we spent together and our kids, I think, were better for it.
Join me each week as I chat with first-generation farmers and ranchers who have what it takes, grit and determination, to start from nothing.
The First Years with Annalisa Laca is available where you access your favorite podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, and now the new AgriTalk app.
Hi, I'm Ag Day host Clinton Griffiths, and I invite you to join me each morning as we cover the nation's food system, from fields of green to orchards of orange and livestock everywhere in between. America runs on agriculture, and here at Ag Day, agriculture's what we do best. Listen as our analysts track the markets, learn about innovations in technology and sustainability, and live the country lifestyle through the eyes of rural America. Join me, Clinton Griffiths, for Ag Day, the country experience.
No matter what you do, you're always raising the bar, trying to do better than ever. New DeLauro fungicide for corn and soybeans can help you get the edge you're looking for. DeLauro has a broader spectrum of disease control and best-in-class dual mode of action residual. Plus, it improves plant health, so your top-performing hybrids and varieties will have the protection they need to help you achieve your personal best yields. DeLauro from Bayer. Keep raising the bar. Always read and follow label instructions.
Farmers are busy harvesting across the country, and most are using the data they collect to evaluate the outcome of the products and the inputs that were used on each field this year. Channel Seedsman Adam Piggott from Cleghorn, Iowa, is here to tell us about the Channel Field Checkup Series using field data and the Channel Custom Crop Report. Adam, give us an overview of the Channel Field Checkup Series.
The Field Checkup Series is a series of on-farm visits conducted by a seedsman during crucial stages such as seedling, vegetative, reproductive, and maturity stages. Seedsmen utilize Climate Field View to collect the data so they can include very crucial information and share that with the grower.
So you've got all this data coming in from the field. How do the Channel seedsmen then turn that around and put it to use for their growers?
Seedsmen are using digital tools such as Climate Field View for the Channel Field Checkup Series to really help us document observations from farmers' fields and to communicate that through digital technology to the grower.
All right, tell me a little bit more about FieldView and how the Channel Field Checkup Series works.
First, the farmer needs to share his data through FieldView with his Channel Seedsman. The Seedsman will then compile all the data throughout the season and create a custom crop report to send to that grower. That crop report can really be sent at any time. I like to send my custom crop reports after collecting all the data through the season and get that to the guys after the maturity stage of Field Checkup Series.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks, Adam. Next time we'll hear more about how the Channel Custom Crop Report is used to begin planning for next season's crops. Farmers can learn more about the Channel Field Checkup Series at channel.com. And you can find Channel on Twitter and Facebook. Just search Channel Seed.
Current price times 1,000 acres, carry the one.
These days, it's hard to make the math work for your soybean fields. The BASF Liberty Link system with Liberty Herbicide makes it easier. Start with a 2-plus bushel per acre yield advantage. Add in lower system input costs and more complete weed control, and you get an extra $33 or more profit potential per acre compared to Asgrow Roundup Ready to Extend soybeans. Grow smart with Liberty Link and BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
You're listening to AgriTalk, where the conversation begins.
And welcome back to AgriTalk, everybody. We're talking with Roger Bernard today. Roger is the policy analyst for Inform Economics. And Roger, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the Senate race there. You think that the Senate is going to stay in control by the Republicans. But in this House, boy, we talked a little bit about some of the numbers. When you put in the solid and the likely House seats, according to the Cook Political Report, right now it would be sitting at 192 Democrat, 193 Republican. But the Democrats are only involved in three toss-ups, and Republicans are holding seats right now in 47 toss-up races out there. Man, when you look at some of the really critical House races out there, Roger, which ones do I identify?
Well, I think, you know, it's with some of these races out there, it's going to be, you know, I realize you keep talking about this, but turnout is just going to loom so large in this whole thing. I think when you go through what's maybe skewing some of this is too, is that you've got the, a number of these races are not ones where there's a sitting Republican. You know, there's a lot of lawmakers have left, and are not, seeking reelection for one reason or another. Well, you know, that starts to really, that I think injects a lot more of those currently Republican held seats into that, unknown or, toss up category. But then you've still got some, in Iowa that are, Michael Young, there's a lot of these have just come in as just, toss ups, maybe a surprise, if you will, in terms of, what's happening. And so, I think, some of the ones here in Iowa are going to be important. Yep. You've got to look at some of those along, in the Carolinas, et cetera. And then what happens as you've got this influx of folk that have moved, south and have brought their politics with them. And that's starting to maybe reshape some of these races as well. So, there's going to be several of these, I think, that could become very, very important. And that's why this one is getting almost so hard to call.
Yeah. Roger, when you talk about the importance of turnout, House District 1 up here in Northeast Iowa is a great example of how turnout is really probably going to be the determining factor here. Because if the voters in Dubuque, Waterloo, Cedar Falls get out and vote, I think that probably puts the lean toward the Democrat candidate, Abby Finkenauer. Now, if we can get our farm vote up in District 1 here in Iowa, I think incumbent Republican Rod Blum probably has the upper hand in the race. But it's all about getting out there and voting, and who's going to actually turn out and vote. So yeah, I get it.
And they, you know, and I'm in the other district, and yeah. Just here, you know, within about an hour and a half ago, I was number 123, and 2 years ago I was number 221, voting at about the same time. So, you know, now, you know, how many of these folks maybe took the advantage of getting into the auditor's office and voting early? Good question. You know, or absentee, et cetera. So, you know, therein is going to be that key issue. Did that Republican base stay yep. energized like it appeared they were coming out of the Kavanaugh election or the right. Kavanaugh hearings, you know, for the right. Supreme Court justice? So that is just, you know, did that tail off enough to, you know, keep some of these voters at home?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And at least here in Iowa, most places, they're not out in the field today. So,
right,
you know.
right. Exactly. Okay, when it comes to impacts on the Ag Committee, you said not much impact on the Senate Ag Committee because you do anticipate that it will remain in Republican control. Yeah. Talk about the impact on the House Ag Committee.
Well, you know, that one's going to be interesting because we get a very known quantity to agriculture in there if the Democrats take the House, and that'd be Colin Peterson.
Yep.
You know, he is one of the, if not the most conservative Democrat out there in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's the thing you find in outstate Minnesota, away from, you know, the northeast part of the state, the Arrowhead, and outside of the Twin Cities. You know, you still have a largely rural population.
Yep.
And, you know, this is historically candidates and lawmakers just can't be extremists on yep. either direction there in order if they want to return. You know, Colin, you know, took that seat in 91. You think he's, you know, that district has grown now. It's basically the whole western half of the state. But as I know you guys have talked about, you know, Colin worked hand in hand with Conaway. All except around the nutrition title of this farm bill that's still pending. Okay. So from that perspective, we really would not expect to see a big shift there. Now, of course, Colin's going to, you know, probably step up some oversight activities of this administration, especially that move of the Economic Research Service and the National Institute for Food and Agriculture. That's probably going to be a new attention point for him. Trade issues are probably also going to be a focal point for Peterson in the event he becomes chairman, you know, because the chairs and such control the agenda. So, you know, I don't get the sense we're going to see a, you know, watershed movement on the House Agriculture Committee, but you're going to see a slightly different focus, you know, as that panel moves forward. Collins made it clear he doesn't want to write a farm bill as his first thing out of the gate. He wants
right.
this thing done before he gets there. So his attention will be on oversight.
Yep. But he'll still want to get it done fairly quickly, won't he?
Oh yeah. Well, I think you're going to get it done. I think in this post-election lame duck session that's coming up, there's been a lot of things already accomplished, I think, staff-wise, etc. So I think the odds that you're going to see this bill move forward in the lame duck are pretty high right now.
Gotcha. Roger, thanks, man. I appreciate you stepping in and getting us up to speed on this election day.
You bet. And for all those out there listening, if you haven't done so already, please go vote.
Go vote. Good stuff. Thanks, Roger. That is Informa policy analyst Roger Bernard. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to Dawn Caldwell and Ashley McDonald for joining us today. Come back this afternoon for AgriTalk After the Bell, Cattle Markets in Focus with Chris Swift from Swift Trading Company. Have a great day, everybody. Go vote.
They say to really know a man, you have to walk a mile in his boots. Well, my channel Seedsman has logged more miles than I can count in mine. As crops grow, so does his commitment to making sure there's nothing overlooked. And come harvest, we celebrate in the cab. Him working away, making plans for next season. Look, anybody can sell you seed. Only a Channel Seedsman gives you everything you need to make the most of it. Find yours at channel.com/boots.
Prepare for the future of ag technology at Farm Journal Media's Ag Tech Expo, December 3rd through the 5th in Indianapolis. Whether you're a novice or a tech-savvy early adapter, Ag Tech is your go-to source for the latest in the industry. Customize your event experience and gain a competitive edge with more than 25 educational breakout sessions focused on precision ag, using data, machinery and iron, and sustainable technology. Grower and retailer registrations only $99. Sign up today at www.farmjournalagtechexpo.com.
Thanks to Acuron Corn Herbicide for sponsoring the AgriTalk podcast. Talk to your retailer about upgrading your weed control with Acuron. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide.